Good evening. Is anybody here for the first time? Welcome. Second time, all right. Anybody here for the 20th time? How about the 500th time? Well, I had a phone conversation several days ago with a friend, a very potent conversation. And I'd like to start by sharing with you about that conversation, because it fits in with something I've been thinking a lot about and that I want to talk about and that I might be talking about for a while. So this is a friend who, it's funny, you know, I haven't spent that much time with her in terms of the actual time of our lives, but the time that we spent together was so deep that I feel like I know her really, really, really well. And what we did was we shared the experience of being at a recovery center together. So we both went with struggling with alcohol addiction, and we spent a month in the Arizona desert at a healing place. And so she's a person with whom I shared a lot, she shared a lot with me, and we went really, really down deep into the kind of underbelly of any of you who have ever struggled with any kind of addiction know that there's an underbelly of suffering that leads us to that as a to try to get relief from our suffering. So this friend left a message on my... Oh, I have to tell you one brief story about her, because otherwise something I say won't make as much sense. So one of the things she shared when we were at this place together was that she had had this experience of being in a hurricane. And she was with a few really good friends, and they were in a house, and there was this hurricane. And they had to go into the center of the house where, because the walls were shaking, and, you know, pieces of the roof outside were starting to fall away. It was huge. And so they went into the center of the house where there were no windows and where the structure of the house was stronger. And she just sat there with a couple of her really good friends for hours, listening to the house be battered by the storm and listening to the house basically be falling apart around them. And pretty much they figured they were going to die. I mean, they didn't know how they were not going to die. So they sat together and experienced that, something that I've never experienced, maybe some of you have, the experience of, oh, we're going to die. And these are the people I'm going to die with. And this is it. And it's over. So she said, they didn't die somehow. I mean, the house kind of all fell around, but where they were didn't. And she said that after she had that experience, she said, I don't fear death anymore, because I got to feel what it feels like that when you're preparing to die. And she's like, okay, I did that. And so I actually, that's one of the things she came away. It was a life-changing experience for her. So she left a message on my phone and said, I'm going to post something on Facebook tomorrow and I want to give you a heads up about it. She said, I've been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and I'm going to be sharing it with my broader community on Facebook. And so I just wanted you to know that that's going to happen, and I'd love to talk with you. Okay. So I read her post, and it was like, so, I don't want to say cheerful, but it was really positive and really strong and pretty much said, you know, don't worry about me. I am okay, and this is something that's happening, and I don't know what's going to happen. And she just had this extremely, it was very powerful and beautiful reading her post. And I thought, wow, okay. I'm not suggesting that that's how one should respond to such a diagnosis, but that's her response. So I called her, and I'm glad I got to talk with her. And we talked for over an hour. And the first thing I said to her was, I was really surprised by the tone of your post. And I'm wondering, you know, tell me about you right now. How are you feeling? What's going on? And she said, well, I feel really awake and alive, and I'm not afraid of death. She says, you know, and she referred to the hurricane experience. Said, you know, I had that experience, and it changed me. And then another thing that she said is, you know, I have this immediate activity of what's in front of me, the things that I have to deal with, the biopsy, the CAT scan, the pop, you know, maybe I can have surgery, and if I can, then I'll have chemo after that. And then she also shared about what it's like to be kind of a lightning rod for all the emotions of all the people around her and her kind of feeling of, I can't help them, I can't save them. Everybody's, you know, kind of freaking out and really sad and all that. She said, but you know what? I do the thing that's right in front of me, and I'm really, really, really clear that all these other things that I worry about in my life doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. I'm alive, and I'm awake, and I'm not afraid to die. The other thing she asked this in her post, she said, would you please focus on positive energy when you engage with me? And this is not a person who is afraid of negative emotion. You know, some of us go to the positive as a way to avoid negative emotion. That's called spiritual bypassing or emotional bypassing, where la, 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 everything's great, even though it's not. That's not how this person is. This person, I bore witness to her going down deep and doing the difficult work of dealing with negative stuff. So it's not that she is avoiding it. But what she said was, she said, you know, I can't afford to expend any of my precious energy there. And I thought, ah, there it is, the great matter. If you're new to Zen, maybe you don't know. I'll tell you. It's written out on the wooden thing out there that we hit, the han. You know, the great matter is we're born and we die. That's the great matter. And there's a way that being around somebody who is so close and clear about this side of the great matter, the death side, it really is just, you get so present and you just get so awake. I do when I'm around that. And I've been around that. I've been around death. Not my own danger of my own yet, but around others as they've died. So this great matter that can just wake us up to really, really get clear on what really matters here and how much time. How do we expend our precious energy, this precious life energy that we have, and our relationships with one another? Every moment, how do we choose to expend that energy? This is, I think, this is the big and beautiful challenge that Shakyamuni Buddha and that our practice offers us. Because this is the practice of being present. That's all it is. I think you alluded to that last week. But I mean, you know, it's in the name Zen. I mean, Zen is the Japanese version of Chan, which is the Chinese version of Dhyana, which means concentration, meditation on what? This moment. Presence. That's what it means to do Zen. It means to be present. And the great matter kind of kicks us into the present. Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, in the Samyukta Agama, I don't know what that is, it's some ancient text that shares a story. The Buddha meets a group of monks who are arguing about who is following a true Dharma and who is following a false Dharma. This is what we like to do. We do this. You and I, we do this. We argue who's following the true Dharma and who's following the false Dharma. And the Buddha dismissed their arguments as fruitless, and he told them, the only purpose of any dharma is to help beings cross the sea of life and death. That's it. That's the only reason for any of this. Some of us who've been around here for a while have had this conversation here and there at emotional moments. And when we realize, there's a good likelihood that many of us will be the people who will be attending to each other's deaths. And I'm not saying that to scare the new people, like, oh no, this is a cult. Now I have to stay forever and I have to die with these people. But see, it's actually already happened. We've had this experience. Craig lived in the house where Ken is now, and he died right here, right in the little house. We took care of him. Catherine, how many of you were here when we did a sesshin and walked down the road to, attend her as she was in her last week of her life? Jean Marie had her seizure right outside there on the, in my arms, right on the porch after class on a Sunday night. And Brian, not so long ago. And my sincere apology if I forgot anybody else. But see, it's actually true. It's not just a kind of a poetical, emotional, little metaphory thing. It's like, it's actually true that, look around the room just for a moment, right now. Look into the eyes of the people that are here. And just imagine, what if it was actually true that some of these people were the people that you were actually going to see around your deathbed when you were preparing to die? It might be true. And if that was true, how would we treat one another? How would we speak with one another? How would we act with one another? This is the great invitation that Shakyamuni Buddha is offering us in this practice of being present with every moment of our lives. But of course, we're human. We get challenged. Things come up. It's really hard to stay that focused. And we lose whatever potency and beauty and we forget. So that's why we have all of our practices, to try to help us get present again, And some of our practices focus on, on physical calming and stilling and concentration. Some of our practices help us with what to do with our minds, what obstructs you. I mean, that's really the question. If the practice is being present with every moment of our life, then I would say, and I say this to myself as well, if you're not present, what's in the way? And that's a really good question. What's in the way for you? And different ones of us have different things that get in the way. For some of it's our thoughts. We get lost in our thoughts about ourselves or about other people, and we're not present. We're in our head. We're in story land. Right. Some of us get stopped by emotional. We get emotionally overwhelmed, and not that there's anything wrong with emotion. As you know, I'm a big proponent of feeling our feelings. And there's a way at times that, just like with thoughts, that emotional kind of fixation and obsession can also cause us to spin away and not be present with one another. There's probably other things, but a lot of our practices are to try to address these very normal human, things that get in the way of being present. So I'd like to... Oh, and wouldn't you know, I didn't bring a watch, so... thank you. Chico-san, maybe I can borrow yours. Thank you. It's a nice old-fashioned... A nice old-fashioned watch with hands and numbers. and a little second hand that goes click, click, click. Wow. I love it. I would like to talk a little bit about kind of some of the guidance from our practice that I'm currently finding to be most helpful with my own obstructions to being present, and talk about some that I think come from the emptiness side and some that come from the form side. Because this is one of the great things about Buddhism, is we don't just have one truth. You don't just have to like follow the party line of what the one truth is. We have two truths. We have the relative and we have the absolute, and they're both true. So it's not like one is subservient to the other. They're both true. The absolute being this experience, and the absolute, sometimes it's called emptiness, or sometimes it's called big mind. There's a lot of different ways we could talk about it. The experience that we have of being completely interconnected with everything, of not being a separate self, but that our self is actually the big self. That experience, empty, it doesn't mean void, it means empty of separate self, interconnected. So there's a lot of guidance and teaching in that way of understanding the world and our humanness. And then there's also the side of the relative, which is this kind of bread and butter form side that we live in. It's the side of the form. It's the relative life of our, you know, falling down and getting into trouble and getting mad at each other and having to go to work and our kids and our parents and, you know, just the stuff of our lives is also a completely a realm of awakening and enlightenment. And in fact, Zen has beautiful, wonderful teachings that I just love and that help us understand that, you know, how both of these are true. And in fact, there's more than two. I've been studying the five ranks. So, I won't get into that tonight, but we'll just stick with the two. But there's more than two. Yeah, so the absolute and the relative. And one quote that I found that I thought was really good about this thing, because it can seem really kind of hard to understand this relative and absolute and how does that work. I think it's here. Let's see if it's here. Right, this is by Reggie Ray, who is a Vajrayana teacher, one of Trungpa's heirs, and I've quoted him many times over the years. I really enjoy his approach to teaching about the Dharma. This is from his book, Touching Enlightenment, and he says, the spiritual journey is not accomplished by disconnecting ourself. So I just want to say a little bit before I say more. We often will hear in Zen, again, kind of the emptiness side, no separate self. Some people will even say no self, that grasping to the idea that we think that we have a self is delusion. And so, you know, you think, oh, well, then if I'm going to be a good Buddhist, I have to not have a self. And then we get in trouble because we do have a self. Try really hard to not have a self. You're going to fail because you do have a self. And to some extent, you know, self has a function. Ego has a function. You know, healthy emotional boundaries, healthy psychological boundaries. You know, if you don't have any sense of healthy psychological boundaries, you have no morality, you have insanity. You know, so it's not that it's bad. As we have to understand, it's not about bad. The spiritual journey is not accomplished by disconnecting ourself from the relative reality of our lives and attaining, he says in quotes, some higher state. Nor is the journey made by ignoring the actuality of our life and seeking a bypass, a passage around it to some distant goal. The spiritual journey of the human person is made only by meeting our relative experience with absolute directness and complete nakedness, and by allowing relative reality to ground, inform, and guide us and bring about the transformation we ultimately seek. Um, So I want to talk a little bit about this side of form, because I've come to find a couple of teachings that are giving me some new understanding about it. And it's the concept of, well, just a minute here. Let me flip my papers, like my root teacher, and like I teased Jean about the other day. Oh yeah, Catherine always would sit up here and she'd go through her papers, she'd flip her papers, you know, there I am. Well, I don't know, I wrote so many notes. It would seem that if we understand the emptiness side, that one of the false understandings, I think, of that are that it somehow means that we're this neutral person who doesn't care about anything. Well, because everything's empty and it doesn't matter. And as we've talked about in here, that doesn't align with our bodhisattva vow to work for the liberation of all beings. We are connected. We are attached. We do care about others. We care deeply about others. That's our path as bodhisattvas in the Mahayana way. So how do we kind of know how to work with being this self who's also realizes that there ultimately is no self, but we have this self? And there's something about this word agency that has really been resonating for me. And I've read this word now a couple times. The first time I read it was in a quote by Robert Aitken, who is one of our great Zen teachers from this century. And this really is embarrassing because I have so many papers and I didn't really organize them. Oh, I didn't bring it? Oh man, hold on just one second. Robert Aitken, really? I didn't bring it? Oh. Oh. Well, it's possible that I didn't. Ah, I did. Thank goodness. Here it is. Okay. So this is something that he said, and I thought this was a really, really, really interesting quote. This is in a book called Encouraging Words, and these are Dharma talks that he gave in his Dharma Center over the years. And he's talking about this thing about action, and he says, "Do you deplore waste? Live by cultivating. Cultivation begins with the agent of realization, the one drawing this breath. Use this breath. Do you deplore violence? Live by nurturing. Nurturing begins with this spoon or this friend. Take care of your spoon. Take care of your friend." So I thought, oh, the agent of realization, that's you. That's me. That's the choices that we make. That's taking care of this spoon, taking care of this friend. That's giving body and meaning to things like our wish to be nonviolent. You know, live by nurturing if you deplore violence. Live by cultivating if you deplore waste. So this idea of being the agent of realization, I started to really think about that. And then I found this. I was rooting around in some of Catherine's old Dharma talks. This was from 1995, 96, I don't know, up at Jokoji. She was teaching us about the Genjo Koan. And she really had this style where she really liked to, when we were all getting really tired and really starting to kind of fall apart and get really emotional, she liked to read us super, super emotional poetry. And we'd all be sitting there like crying. And she'd just keep reading it. Just, you know. And I remember one time even somebody, it wasn't somebody from our community, but it was somebody from another community. It's like, oh, stop. It was like too much. But she kept going. So this was one of those ones. This was one of those ones that she read when we were just, and I remember we were just like bawling when she read this. But it's exactly the same thing. It's about agency. It's about being the agent of your realization by acting in accord with your deepest sense of what is real and what is true and what is it that needs to be done. And to me, this completely resolves that whole dilemma, you know, we've been talking about here about how, oh my God, we're Buddhists and politics and what are we supposed to do? It's like, no problem. Just be present in your life and act. You know, don't argue about what's the right dharma and the wrong dharma. Present, act. And I would say act knowing that the people around you might be the people who are the ones that are at your deathbed. So that's kind of a helpful Geiger counter maybe for guiding our activity. So Mary Oliver, now she wasn't technically a Buddhist, but us Buddhists love to read Mary Oliver, so maybe, I don't know, there's some affiliation there. This is a little bit long, and it's not a poem. It's something she was writing. It's one of her essays. So I'll read you the whole thing. She says, deep in the woods, I tried walking on all fours. I did it for an hour or so. That's Mary Oliver. I did it for an hour or so. Through thickets, across a field, down to a cranberry bog. I don't think anyone saw me. At the end, I was exhausted and sore, but I had seen the world from the level of grasses. I was some slow old fox, wandering, breathing, hitching along, lying down finally at the edge of the bog, under the swirling rickrack of the trees. You must never stop being whimsical, and you must not ever give anyone else the responsibility for your life. I don't mean it's easy or assured. There are stubborn stumps of shame, grief that remains unsolvable after all the years, a bag of stones that goes with one wherever one goes, and however the hour may call for dancing and for light feet. But there is also the summoning world, the admirable energies of the world, better than anger, better than bitterness. And there is the thing that one does, the needle one plies, the work. And within that work, a chance to take thoughts that are hot and formless and to place them slowly and with meticulous effort into some shapely, heat-retaining form. Even as the gods or nature or the soundless wheels of time have made forms all across the soft, curved universe, that is to say, having chosen to claim my life, I have made for myself out of work and love a handsome life. I did not give to anyone the responsibility for my life. It is mine. I made it and can do what I want with it, live it, give it back someday without bitterness to the wild and needy dunes. Such a master, such a lived life. And this feeling to me so strongly of agency. You know, she's the one who famously said, what are you going to do with your one precious, wild and precious life? And this is all of our questions, our question every day, every single day. And sometimes, like this time that we're in, makes it particularly important to pay attention to that question. So, you know, we have the Zen story of the ancestor who, you know, I won't tell the whole story, but a, there was a poetry contest, and one of the monks had written a poem that basically implied, you know, the mirror's really dusty, you better shine it really hard if you want to be enlightened. And the other monk wrote something like, there's no mirror, there's no dust, what is there to keep clean? And that was the one who is our ancestor. And so that's the side that we usually favor, and we say, oh, right, there's no mirror, there's no dust. But actually, they're both true. It's just form and emptiness, because there is dust, and we do have to clean the mirror, you know, even though there isn't a mirror and there is no dust. There is. See, and these are the two truths, and they're both true. And sometimes they're true at different times, and sometimes they're true at the same time, and that's one of the big lovely paradoxes that we get to study and try to figure out in our tradition. So I think I've been talking about the form side. The form side is about that you have a life and that you have the opportunity to make choices about how you live and what you do. So what about the emptiness side? You know, that's always a little harder to talk about because it's beyond words, and it's indescribable, and yet, of course, we talk about it. We try to talk about it. So I found something that I thought, oh, well, this is, I'd totally forgotten about it. It's something that I wrote. And it's when we were studying the Diamond Sutra, which is a lovely teaching. And one of the teachings, one of the core teachings, actually, in the Diamond Sutra is that the bodhisattva, and we imagine that we are bodhisattvas, we are beings who are here to support the awakening of others. That's our family style here in our Soto Zen. The teaching of the Diamond Sutra is that if you're a bodhisattva, that you don't create the perception of a self. That's one of the big lines in the Diamond Sutra. Not creating the perception of a self. Not clinging to a dharma or a non-dharma. So not clinging to either form or emptiness. Not creating the perception of a self. And when I was studying this, I did something that I often do, which is I take a teaching and then I challenge myself to try to express, what does this mean for me in my life, in my this life and my relationships with people. Particularly, I usually focus on relationships with people, kind of a relational type. And so I went through chapters 6, 7, and 8 of the Diamond Sutra, and I made myself write my own kind of instructions about how to live and what to do according to what I was understanding from the Diamond Sutra. And I'd like to read you what I came up with because I just found this the other day. I've been going through a lot of my papers. I've been working on a writing project. And if you've read the Diamond Sutra, you may hear what I say and say, what? But if you actually took this and you go and you've put it against chapters 6, 7, and 8, that was what I was doing when I wrote this, was trying to interpret those three chapters. So, and it really feels related to what I'm talking about now. So this is me giving myself instruction about what does it mean to not create the perception of a self, which is the core of the practice of emptiness, is no self. So here's what I wrote. I don't know who you are. I don't know why you did what you did. I don't know what you should do. Let's just pay attention together. Here, for a minute, and see what arises. What's true now in our minds, hearts, and bodies? Let's speak it. Let's listen to it without commentary, grasping, holding, attributing meaning, cause, or consequence. When I feel my body constrict and contract, open it up. Breathe into the tightness. When I feel my mind grasp onto an idea and start spinning it into a web of meaning, into a hard knot of solid matter, stop. Step back. Release the thought and the words. Let go of the story. Sense the space around us. Listen with the eyes, think with the heart. Let the diamond of prajna, of grounded wisdom, cut through our illusion. Sink deeper into the muscle and nerves of the body. Become aware of the feelings this brings up, feelings I'd rather avoid. It's only by studying my attachments and ego constructions that I can see that they are a construction, and hence something I can release. In truth, there's nothing to hold on to. If we need guidance, rather than looking to what's right and what's wrong, consider, what is my ground? What action will benefit all beings? What will best allow the world to come forth? Here's what matters, and it's all that matters. Helping beings cross the ocean of birth and death. So back to where I started. That's what we're doing here. So rather than flip more through my papers and read you more interesting things that I found here and there, I'd love to open it up for what is arising in you right now, either in response to anything I said or just thinking about this issue of the great matter and the challenge of wisely using ourselves or whatever else you're maybe wanting to bring up. Yes.
The thing that I've noticed about not having self or not, and I feel like when you're around other people, then it's like you listen to them and you become what they are saying. And then, like, you become one with wherever you are. It's like you're one with those people there or the trees or, you know, wherever
yes.
you are. It's like you become one with that thing. And I do want to say, though, that it's important to, like you were saying before, to be around positive things that bring health to yourself and to others, because I know that if you're around people or, you know, things that are happening that are not so good and you become one with that, then that's not good.
True. And sometimes you have to be in those environments, and so sometimes we have to learn how to practice with that as well. And yet we do have, there is a choice often, and where we put ourselves and what we pay attention to and what we feed and what we nourish definitely is an important piece of it. I know what you were just saying, I had the thought the other day where I was in a meeting, and, it's hard for me right now to, you know, there is so much negativity around in the world and in politics that, I was really gratified to be in an environment. This was a bunch of social service people who, you know, no matter what the news is happening, no matter what they're doing in Washington, these people are going to work every day and are feeding children and are, you know, taking care of elders and are making good things happen in Watsonville. And, you know, and there's a lot of people in this room who do that too. You know, whatever else is going on, you just cultivate well-being for other people. And it was really important for me, I realized, to be in environments like that, like to actually be sitting there and just absorbing and seeing and being with these people who are just doing what they need to do and taking care of business. And it was, I think, an example of how, you know, the positive environment is an important thing. Yes.
And that is that as you were reading it, I was thinking, oh yeah, sure, just like drop it, step back from it. And I'm wondering what you think about the affect of humility, which has always seemed to me to be really fundamental to Bodhicitta. And
that kind of like, actually, I don't really know what the solution is, even though I'm pretty attached to my
kids, yes.
This would be the right solution.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about that and how you think about it?
Oh, I think the word humility is a really good word and an important word. And, you know, whenever I say something like what I'm going to say right now, I always feel like I have to make sure that everybody understands that the opposite is also true. So whenever I say how I think that, you know, the great challenge, say, of the, you know, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. There is an invitation that we have as students of Buddhism to actually challenge ourselves to just stop it, just cut it out, stop it, drop it. You know, and that does take humility, because they're precious. Our opinions and our views are so precious. We spend so much time cuddling them and feeding them and taking care of them and dressing them, and they're ours and they're our children and they're right, you know, and it's really hard to do that, you know. And that said, there are times when we must have an opinion and we must take a stand and we must exert our influence and our force, you know. And so I think where wisdom comes in is, you know, and nobody can tell you which is which. Nobody can tell you, is this a time, you know, I think we talked about it, I think last time I gave a talk and I was talking about surrender, and I think it was Richard who said something about, well, what about when you have to pick up the sword? Like, sometimes you have to pick up the sword, you know? And I said, yeah, it's true. I think not for all of us, but for some, sometimes you have to pick up the sword, right? And go, okay, no, Manjushri, you know? But that said, the other side is drop the sword, lay down our swords and shields. Lay down our swords and shields and just study war no more. And to me, very intentionally, the opening line of that, you know, I don't know. I don't know, really. And we don't know. We spend so much time in our own, you know, defending our and presenting our own view. And then when the other's talking, we're not really, like you said, we're not really listening. We're actually planning our next our comeback, right? I don't know, I do that. Ooh, they said that, I'm going to say that, you know? But we're not just going, let me actually, you know, let's just say that again. What? Maybe I could try to understand, you know? Hard to do. And yet, I bet you do it sometime. Do you ever do it?
Never.
Yeah, some of us just never do, right? Yeah, occasionally.
Can I follow up and ask you a question?
Absolutely.
So you just said, so sometimes it is, for yeah. Some people, the right thing to pick up the sword.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, just to use kind of the examples of the time, and I don't mean to kill somebody. Yeah, I'm speaking the sword of just cutting through the no. It's the no. You know, sometimes you have to say no. Don't do that.
Okay.
Stop.
The sword is a boundary. Then.
Boundary, you know. Or I would say it could be, you know, strong action that you know the other really isn't going to like firing somebody or kicking somebody out of an office that they've been elected to, or, you know, those, you know, treason. I mean, you know, there's times when it's like, no, you actually need to not just stop, but like, you know, I think that sometimes that is, you know, and then, you know, of course we could get into arguing the right and the wrong dharma about that, and I have no solution to that, because there's always probably another angle to it that somebody could point out, and then they'd probably be right. You know, like if, for me, I start thinking sometimes, well, those people even that I think are so wrong, they have their causes and conditions. They have their lives that have led them to be the way that they are and to do what they're doing. And probably if I had lived their life, I might make the exact same choices they do, you know? And so then that's our dilemma is, wow, having this compassion and this ability to empathize, at the same time, sometimes I may need to be very decisive and do something that they're not going to like. It's hard. It's really hard. Yeah.
Well, an example, Dana and Kathy, for me, is with this issue of doing what's necessary. And I always think back to Rev's book, Being Upright, which he really goes.
Yes.
He's fearless about it.
Yes.
You know, and he just.
Good example.
Yeah, that's a great example. His book's so wonderful and worth reading. You know, but he really. He says it for me, I think. And it isn't. There is no limit to what happens with that sword because it depends on the circumstance. Mm-hmm. That sword, even in killing, may be saving countless lives of innocent people. You don't. You know, it's not known, but an example, for example, is, we're in the presence of a situation where one being, let's say an adult, is behaving in a way where maybe he's or she is at the point of killing an innocent child. You know, you think of those things. There are going to be situations where. It would really not be appropriate to stand by in silence as a witness. Mm-hmm. That's a time to become physically active. Mm-hmm. You may decide, the limit of my physical activity would be to get between the two so that I become the defending bearer. But it also may be to physically restrain in order to save that person that's doing it and the person that's being done to. So that's what I mean. With the idea of the sword, and the answer is, yeah, it could be almost, there's, under the right circumstances, under the appropriate circumstances, there's no, it's what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And it's done from a place of where we've practiced enough, hopefully, done from a place of quiet and forgiveness and love and kindness.
Yeah.
That's the core.
Well, I think so, and I fully understand and appreciate if others have a different view, because this is a kind of a controversial thing to talk about because
it's interesting.
Yeah, it is, and we grapple with it. I think many of us grapple with this very question. Thank you. I didn't know if you'd be inspired or if you'd think my speech was a bummer, a downer. I knew I wanted to talk about this, but I thought, oh God, you know, it could be like a real, like, Kathy, really?
I loved it. And apart from me.
I think for me the main thing is just to... I so appreciate that, you know, the opportunity that we have, that this is what, I believe this is what Buddha is inviting us to do, is to wake up. Like, really? And if we can help each other remember that, you know, remind each other of that in how we are with each other, all the better. Do you have another point?
Yeah. I really enjoyed what you were saying, and on the last thing that we were just talking about, I practice martial arts called Hukukmusul, and I've been doing that for 2 years. And the thing that I've learned a lot from doing martial arts is it opens your mind to how much violence you are capable of, and that other people are capable of. And because you are basically practicing a martial art, which is violence, you are actually becoming more peaceful, because as you are doing the practice, you become more peaceful because you see what can happen when you use that kind of violence. And so I think that based on the practice of martial arts, that the idea would be to try to help other people to not use violence.
Yeah.
And that would be the best thing to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think this will be our last comment.
Which is really a question that I struggle with, and I'm sure all of you do, which is in any given situation, to really think through and feel through and get the gut sense of what the most loving, appropriate response is in that situation at that time to respond.
Yeah. That's it, Stan. I think that's beautifully said. You know, is this wholesome? Is this going to what will most benefit beings? What will most support or relieve suffering? Yeah, in this moment, what can I do to most relieve suffering, most liberate others?
And I want to ask you how you deal with that.
Well, I just try to remind myself to ask that question. And I think for me, the biggest thing is to really watch not reacting.
Yes.
Yeah, hold the reaction, because I can get very fiery. I can get very fiery and very reactive and very righteous and intoxicated with my power of expression. And I have learned to pause before I think that I'd say that's one of the things I've learned over the hard way, to pause before I react or speak and settle in and actually do get as present as I can and really look and be with the other and heart connection and then act, you know. And it still might be something that's on the harder edge rather than soft and warm and fuzzy, but it is usually has a much better outcome if I can remember to do that.
That's my experience.
Yeah, good.
But it's an ongoing job.
Of course it is. Yes, that's why we call it practice.
Yes, practice.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we are we're 1 minute over time. And I think that we have some treats. Shakti brought some fresh muffins. Yeah? So we're going to have tea after the lecture in here. And there's some cookies and some fresh homemade muffins for those who wish to have them. So I wish us all, I don't know how to do, you know, you do such nice, like, May echoes, creative echoes. Let me try. Okay, I'll challenge myself. Okay, may the merit of our time together this evening support all of us to be as awake as we possibly can be, working for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless, I bow to them. Delusions are inexhaustible.